Thanks, everyone. I want to get going because I know we've got a real action-packed panel here. I'm real excited about it. Some really great speakers here. Tim Davis from Bowling Green State University, who's traveled the world on hunting down algae, along with his colleague here, Mike McKay. He had a conflict. Mike's, I'm sure, going to be fully capable of giving us a real good rundown on some of the global algae issues, too, as is their colleague, Steve Wilhelm from the University of Tennessee. Mike earlier this year got back from a trip to Africa's Lake Victoria, and he's also he's a Canadian who has also enjoys studying algae in places that people normally don't look for it, like underneath ice and in colder climates. So that's pretty cool. Right to my immediate left is Lynn Henning. She's the 2010 Goldman Prize winner. For those of you who don't know, the Goldman Prize is the most prestigious in the world for environmental grassroots activism. There's only one every year chosen from each continent. Lynn in 2010 became the first CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, activist to win that prestigious award. And she met President Obama, spoke at Washington Mall on Earth, out at Earth Day, and has always been a leader nationally and internationally on citizen science, studying, double-checking what the agencies are telling you or not telling you about what's in your water, your creeks and ditches, tributaries leading out to larger bodies of water. And she and her husband, Dean, who's in the audience with us today, are Lenawee County farmers right here in southeastern Michigan. So we're glad to have Lynn. To her left is John Rumpler, a senior attorney with Environment America. And are you also part of the U.S. PERG, aren't you?
The PERGs are part of our larger networks, but I work for Environment America.
Yeah, and John's looked at this issue from across North America and has some good data on where some of the problem areas are as well. And then I already mentioned Mike McKay from Bowling Green State University. Steve Wilhelm from the University of Tennessee is at the over by the computer table now, and the young man down there at the far end with the green sweater, that's Bill Mitch. Bill and I have known each other for 25 years. He's one of the world's top wetlands experts. Bill's been to China, he's set up a project northwest Ohio looking at the how the potential of trying to revive portions of the Great Black Swamp could be used in modern days to help reduce our algae problem. He's worked on the red tide issue down in the Gulf of Mexico. He's very, very well known for his wetlands work and advocacy there. So anyways, let's get started because we got a lot to get in here in our amount of time. Steve Wilhelm is going to give us a perspective on some of the algae hotspots around the world.
Tom, if you hit the button on the off button right behind you, you'll kill the lights.
All right.
Great.
Thanks, Tom. So 5 minutes, not specifically sure what you guys want to hear about, but I'm a microbial ecologist. I have a team of graduate students, undergraduate students, professional scientists, and we kind of travel around the world trying to understand what causes events like what you're seeing behind me. What you're looking at is a video from Lake Taihu in China. We shot this one in 2014. As part of a long-term study we've had going on there. We've been working there for about 10 years with scientists from Ohio, from Michigan, from scientists from North Carolina, and trying to ask questions about what causes these events. The blooms in Taihu have been going on for about 50 years. It's a similar organism to what we see growing in Lake Erie, Microcystis aeruginosa, a few other things. And we started working in China because we had this idea that in the Great Lakes, we might start seeing Microcystis blooms in 20 or 30 years. Our problem, of course, is we were off by 20 or 30 years. What we use as tools mainly is molecular biology. If you watch CSI on TV, you always see them trying to sequence DNA and talk about genes and stuff. That's what we do for a living, but we do it at a slightly larger scale. Where they're looking at one or two things, we're looking at millions and sometimes billions of sequences to try to ask what the microbes are seeing, what the microbes are trying to do. And what we're finding is that it's much more complicated than we ever thought. There's not one classic limiting nutrient out there. There's not one thing controlling these blooms. They're out there, they're proliferating, and they're fighting for everything. They're fighting to get nutrients, they're fighting for carbon dioxide, they're fighting off their own pathogens. So what we think going forward then is that we've moved to an era now where we've got chemists, we've got biologists, we've got physicists, and we've got mathematical modelers, and we're beginning to understand not only how we get so much algae, but why we get certain types of algae. And that's really the key, is trying to figure out not necessarily how much is there, but who's there. And so that's what our interests are, and I'd be glad to talk about with that about anyone who's interested.
Can we put
Thanks, Steve. That's what one thing I found in researching in working on the Toledo water crisis. How many parallels there were to Lake Taihu in China? They had I'm sure you guys have heard about the Toledo water crisis in 2014. They had a much more severe one in Lake Taihu before ours. That you know, again, we had some warning signs that maybe could have helped us avoid what we did. But it's. It's fascinating to me, and maybe you can answer this. I thought I had heard from somebody that whereas Lake Erie's algae primarily is a problem during the summer, that Lake Taihu's can last up to 9 months. Is that right?
Yeah, Lake, and hopefully you can hear me without the microphone. Mm-hmm. Lake Taihu is it's a lot warmer in that region. It's about 10 degrees farther south, and we'll see blooms now that start in early March and end in late October. In fact, this was shot in early October of 2014. These type of blooms, when we do see events in Lake Erie, they tend to be smaller, and they tend to be for maybe 6 weeks or so at the most. Although we have seen blooms occur late in the season as well.
Okay, thanks. Mike, can you take it from there and tell us about some other
areas? Thanks, Tom. I brought along just a few slides with some images. I think just helps to set of the framework. And actually, following on your comment, Tom, about the comparison between Erie and Taihu, even within Erie, Sandusky Bay, for example, for those of you not familiar with Sandusky Bay, it's an embayment on the south shore of Lake Erie in Ohio. That bloom there starts in late April, early May, and it's still going on right now. So we've had a constant bloom of cyanobacteria, different from the bloom we see in the Western Basin. Which is the image you're seeing here. This is a Landsat satellite image taken last year. This was September 26th. And we had a fairly large expanse of bloom in the western basin of Lake Erie. So for those of you who are not familiar with the local landscape here, what you're seeing is the Detroit River coming up from the flowing down from the north. You see actually a plume. Most of you probably think about Detroit and the Detroit River and just think automatically contaminated, polluted. Actually, the Detroit River is carrying water from Lake Superior, Lake Huron, directly down into Lake Erie. So what you see there is actually a plume of relatively clean water in terms of lack of phytoplankton. Okay, the low nutrients in that water, which is derived from the northern lakes, is actually depleted of nutrients that are supporting phytoplankton. It's not until that water enters into Lake Erie where we start seeing nutrients coming in, mainly from the Maumee River, which is flowing into the lake from the southwest. On that image, you can see the city of Toledo in the lower right corner. And maybe you could. It looks like it's intensified the greenish color in that image, and that's largely because of nutrients coming in from the Maumee draining a large watershed, which is roughly 6,000 or 7,000 square miles, 90% agricultural activity. Next one, Steve. And the next one. So I mentioned that image of Lake Erie from September 26th. This actually is from the Maumee River downtown Toledo, same day. So as Tom's quite well aware, we had a large bloom of Microcystis, this cyanobacterium, in downtown Toledo, extending from the mouth of the river at Lake Erie up about 15 miles or so, and it was really quite striking, the images. And I think, you know, Tom mentioned the water crisis in Toledo of 2014. This caused a lot of panic in the city. People, you know, it was still fresh in their memories. Now, the water supply for Toledo is actually coming from the western basin of Lake Erie. It's not coming from the river. So the water safety, drinking water safety, wasn't compromised by this bloom. But again, having it at your footstep really reinforces the problems that we're having in the western
basin. Yeah, it sure did. As I was talking, telling some people that a lot of people don't get on a boat. They see images on social media or the images on TV, but to have it front and center downtown. And we had a new development downtown, Promenade Park, that had been taken out of public use for a couple of years, redeveloped as a brand new shining jewel of a park right on the waterfront. And here we had this algae move in, and we had a major regatta that almost got canceled. But I just wanted to reinforce your point, Mike, that this was a real eye-opener. And some argue may have even had an effect in our mayoral election that year.
So, that's true, yeah. Now, in the session description, you know, Tom's trying to reach out and recognize that this is truly a global issue. We held a symposium on the campus at BGSU in spring of 2015, following the Toledo water crisis, where we drew upon global knowledge in this environmental problem, recognizing that folks around the world are dealing with the same problems, and can we learn from what they're doing? So the next couple slides I've got are just showing you some areas where I've done some work in past years. The first one, next one, Steve. Yeah, this is just, so I've done work in the Baltic Sea. Now the Baltic Sea is not a lake, but it's called a marginal sea. It's a brackish environment, marginal sea in terms of its relatively limited circulation. Lots of freshwater influence, especially from the north. So you go from salinity. Well, you go from essentially almost fresh water in Bothnian Bay down to maybe about 10 or 11 parts per thousand salinity, close to the German coastline. Normal salinity for seawater is 35 parts per thousand. Next slide, Steve. The issue with the Baltic, we have cyanobacterial blooms that have occurred in the Baltic for decades. One of the connecting factors behind a lot of these blooms, one is agriculture, but another one is a lot of times the water resources are influenced or are bounded by multiple jurisdictions. Okay, so where governments can't come to some consensus about how to treat the problem. We have this issue in Lake Erie. Now, we do have a very functional international joint commission that tries to deal with those issues, but the same thing happens around the world. We have 9 countries that bound the Baltic Sea prior to the Soviet influence declining in the late 1980s. You know, we had countries that really weren't talking to each other in terms of these environmental concerns. We've got countries which are not bordering the Baltic Sea, which are having a high influence on the blooms. Belarus, for example. Rivers flowing from Belarus, heavily agricultural economy. When people can't see the effect of their actions, that is oftentimes a real problem. And in terms of Belarus, they oftentimes don't know what the effect of their farming practices is doing to the Baltic. Steve, next slide there. Lake Balaton. So we've spent, I've taken Bowling Green students to Lake Balaton on several occasions. Lake Balaton, I'd like to draw similarities between western basin of Lake Erie and Lake Balaton. Roughly the same size, very shallow lake is Balaton. Balaton's problems have actually largely been addressed. They still have some blooms, but in the The late 1970s, early 1980s, they engaged in a large geoengineering project at the western end of the lake. And you can see sort of at the bottom left of Lake Balaton, the sort of a greenish area on the map on the right. That's called the Kiss-Balaton National Park wetland area. And they have one river that flows into Balaton called the Zala River. It's flowing from the west. It was carrying large amounts of nutrients into Balaton. They were suffering the same cyanobacterial blooms we have in Western Basin of Lake Erie. In the late 1970s, after Hungary joined the Ramsar Convention for protection of wetlands, the country actually took action and re-engineered a wetland. So as Tom mentioned, Bill does a lot of work in has done a lot of work in the Great Black Swamp, you know, the border of Western Lake Erie. This was a similarly functioning wetland for Lake Balaton. They're able to re-engineer that wetland, and it's been highly effective. Now, a couple of socioeconomic issues that helped succeed. Hungary was still a socialist communist state at that time. Issues regarding, you know, eminent domain and other things that will allow you to undertake a geoengineering project like that were not a concern like they would be here. So just different issues can lead to different outcomes. And one final slide, Steve. This is Lake Victoria. Tom mentioned that we had a contingent from Bowling Green visit Lake Victoria in April. We have some partnerships with universities in Kenya. And we got to visit Kisimu. So three countries bordering Lake Victoria, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. And similar issues, agriculture, although in this case we also have concerns about untreated human waste that enter into Lake Victoria and are also, in the end, it's just nutrients, you know, whether it's human waste or whether it's agricultural runoff. It's nitrogen and phosphorus, and the cyanobacteria don't see it any differently. They just see those nutrients, and that helps to support the growth. So algal blooms, cyanobacterial blooms, a big problem in Victoria as well. And I'll end there.
Thanks a lot, Mike. And just to follow on a couple things you said, that at Bowling Green State University, after the Toledo water crisis, they did have a fascinating two-day conference I went to, bringing in experts from all around the world, talking about algal blooms in Australia and in China and Africa and many other areas, as well as other parts of North America. And, you know, the common denominator almost everywhere is climate change and agriculture and poor land use. And one other thing you mentioned, Sandusky Bay in Lake Erie, it's a different animal. Both Mike and his colleague George Bolderjohn, who was on our Lake Erie tour on Thursday, and another colleague of theirs, Tim Davis, who was formerly with NOAA, that algae is called plankton bricks, and it acts differently and has different symptoms and characteristics, and the primary one in Western Lake Erie is called Microcystis. But they both produce the same toxin, and they're both, you know, what are known as cyanobacterial or harmful algal blooms. But I'd like to move on to Bill Midge next. And Bill, if you could... it's okay. I'll continue because people can hear me, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, Bill, if you can give us your perspective on the value of wetlands, what we're missing by not having, just so you know, Ohio is second only to California in historic wetland acreage lost. And
it should come up. You have to put your...
It's up there.
Take it away, Bill.
All right, thanks. I think this will work. Hold on. Yeah, well, that's just who I am. That also is one of my many lovely mangrove swamps that I study now down in Southwest Florida. So I'm going to talk about creating and restoring wetlands to solve harmful algal blooms in our polluted landscapes. Let's just start with that. We got a trashed landscape almost all the way around the developed world. And so it's not surprising that we have these many harmful algal blooms. We're at a dead end. We can't make our land more nutrient rich if we had to. So everything that goes on land goes into a body of water now. I'll just acknowledging my team. That's one of my four slides. Don't worry. And we call it the Everglades Wetland Research Park, and I'm based in Naples, Florida. So when you come down for a holiday or to get out of the cold, you can do that. Is that supposed to be working?
It's not working. It's recording.
Oh, okay.
For people who can't be here.
All right. So here I'm going to give Mitch lecture outline. I think I have 8 bullets, so hopefully we'll get done in 8 minutes. Global wetland losses. That's something that I'm passionate about reversing, and reversing in a big way. Not just stopping, reversing. And there are all sorts of statistics around. There's one statistic that says we lost half our wetlands in the world in the 20th century. There was a report in LinkedIn. Doesn't everybody read LinkedIn for all their news? There was a report in LinkedIn last week that said 35% of the world's wetlands were lost since 1970. So every time there's a report out, it's more outstanding. So we've lost easily half, if not more, of our wetlands in the world, and I think we've got to stop that and reverse the trends. So harmful algal blooms, you already heard about that, so I won't. You guys know they're everywhere. So my thesis is on reversing the world's wetland losses, goal number one, and cleaning up the waters of the world, goal number two. Can we do two things at once? Well, yes, because wetlands are known for their many, many ecosystem services. So anyhow, that's my thesis, that if we start to get serious about solving these problems, as you heard, Lake Balaton, wherever Florida Everglades, wherever wetlands have been tried, they work. They clean up the water. They do good things. We've got it down to 15 parts per billion of total phosphorus down in the Everglades now. So 3 case studies I'll just mention real quickly. The Mom River Basin, that stands, by the way, for the Mississippi, Ohio, Missouri. I got tired of them calling, you know, I was from Ohio. I taught at Ohio State for many years. I got tired of them saying the Mississippi River Basin when really most of the water was coming down the Ohio. So we decided to call it the Mom, in other words, Mississippi, Ohio, Missouri. And we just published a paper, by the way, sort of suggesting it should be called the Ohio River all the way down to New Orleans. And this got published in a peer-reviewed journal, folks. And I don't think the upper Mississippi people have seen that yet. So Mom River Basin is a 40% of the United States, and it's dumping a ton of nitrogen, especially from, well, not you guys. You guys are Great Lakes. But from about two-thirds of the way of Ohio, dumping nitrogen down to the Gulf of Mexico, causing this hypoxia. I don't have time to describe it, except it's a gigantic area. It used to be described as the size of the state of, let me get it right, New Jersey. They were always picking on New Jersey. So the hypoxia was the size of New Jersey until we got a Democrat in there running the, or was it a Republican? I don't remember. We got a shift in the woman who was running the EPA, and all of a sudden it was almost the size of Massachusetts. But nevertheless, it's a gigantic dead area in the bottom waters of the Gulf of Mexico.
Christine Todd Whitman, yeah. She's from New Jersey.
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Christine Todd Whitman, perhaps?
She
was former governor of New Jersey.
Yes, she was in New Jersey, so she didn't like hearing it being called the size of New Jersey. Okay, so anyhow, I've been passionate about that issue for all the time I was at Ohio State, and even now I'm down on the Gulf of Mexico. I'm actually closer to the Gulf, and nothing's been done. Our recommendation on that, I'm going to give you some big numbers for each of these, but our recommendation for that, to solve that problem, was to build 5 million acres of bottomlands and wetlands in the Mississippi River Basin. 5 million acres. Do you think it's happened? Of course not. There was not a federal agencies ran for the hills when they saw our report. And it was a formal federal report that we did for them, and it was published again in Bioscience in the year 2001. So we've been sitting on that idea. We know that's what it'll take, something on that scale, if they're going to fix the hypoxia. Florida Everglades, that is my passion now. I'm down there. I'm watching what is going on, and it's getting worse every year as to what they're planning. I wish all these agencies sometimes would just go away. They're making more trouble than they're solving. They now have a $2 billion plan to build a reservoir. It's called the EAA Reservoir. Anybody heard this thing? Okay. It's you know, a couple billion here and there, and you're starting to spend money. And we're worried that this plan, which will send the water south, that's the whole point of fixing the Everglades. The mantra is send the water south, send the water south. The trouble is the Everglades is what's south, so it better be damn clean water, really clean water. And the plan that they now have, the $2 billion project, may be a $2 billion gigantic, humongous, irreversible mistake. Maybe. I'm not convinced that they really thought it through on water quality. Okay, so that's what's going on down there now. And the sideshows, we've got two sideshows going on as well. One is called Blue-Green Algae. The Caloosahatchee River is so green you can walk across it right now. And that comes out of Lake Okeechobee. You guys have heard of Lake O. And that water is spewing to our coastlines, to the Gulf, and to the Atlantic side, making a mess. And the worst thing going on this year right now is red tide. And it gets pressed like something. I've never seen any press coverage on this. We've been on, and we started the national press by my university decided to invite CNN down there. And then I made the mistake of telling my university, hey, I'm going to do an experiment, and we're going to maybe find out where the water's coming from. That's all I had to say. They called CNN. CNN was down there within 24 hours and on a boat with us. And I'll tell that story later if I have time. If I don't, it involves the press, sugar, Bill Mitch's career, and a whole bunch of other things. So the Florida Everglades has all sorts of nutrient issues, and the biggest issue probably now is where is the nitrogen that's probably giving a booster shot to red tide? Where is that coming from? Great Black Swamp in Western Lake Erie. Interestingly, I didn't get too involved in that until I went down to Florida and sort of had a metric now that wetlands can be used. They can be used because they've built 57,000 acres of wetlands in Florida to take phosphorus out of the water, and they work. It's another example, Balaton's one too, where this is tried and true, but the agencies just stay away from them. They retreat to their best management practices, and we're not going to solve the eutrophication, and yes, I use that old term, in Lake Erie until they wise up and realize it's going to be wetlands or nothing. I wish I could have put a picture up here, but you guys all know that there used to be a big swamp west of Lake Erie, and it was called the Black Swamp. And so, again, calculations checked out. What do we need to get down to the 40% reduction that you're talking about? We need 100,000 acres of wetlands. Write that down. Take it to the bank. That is a good number with a little bit of safety factor in there. The Florida Everglades, by the way, guess what we need? 100,000 acres of wetlands. And it has to come out of the sugar fields, and that's why they don't like me. Mom River Basin, I told you, that's astronomical. That's 5 million acres, and I don't think it's going to happen in any of our lifetimes. But that's, you know, when the federal government asked me, what's it going to take to solve the problem? That's what we told them. One little thing, Tom, you mentioned it, so I have to put it up here. Wetlaculture is the term. If you Google wetlaculture, you will find our quotes with it because we're the only ones that use that word. It's a new approach for sustainable agriculture with wetlands. And it will take me much too long to explain what it is now. But that's the experiment that Tom referred to that we have in the Black Swamp going on right now. We have one in Buckeye Lake, also in Ohio, and then we just built one in Naples, Florida. So we have three of these experiments. They are 10-year experiments, in my view. That's a lot of graduate students because we're not going to keep our graduate students for 10 years. And it's a new approach for sort of having a balanced landscape of agriculture and wetlands, but a balanced agriculture where we're basically running our agriculture and our agriculture economy on recycled nutrients, and we can just shut off that fertilizer tap. That's the idea. Do I have time to tell a story?
Go for it, real quick.
Okay, story. Just stretch all these words together, and you can sort of see. You have red tide, you have ambitious university PR department, the press, sugar, and professor's research career, all intermingled down there. and it was really kind of scary for a while. We took, I told you that my university sort of talked CNN to coming down there and going on a boat trip that we had planned, and what we were doing was isotope work. We were just planning. We had already been doing some isotope analysis in Lake Okeechobee, which is the freshwater lake that's causing all the trouble down there. So we said, "Well, gee, we'll just go out in the coastal waters and measure some isotopes, get some isotopic signatures, and see if they match." Well, this study became known as the smoking gun. That's CNN's term. And CNN, when they did this piece, anybody see that thing? It was about a month ago. Well, it was on the late evening show with what's his name?
Anderson Cooper.
Who?
Anderson Cooper.
Yeah, Anderson Cooper was there. And right in the middle of the piece, for the most part, they did what I consider to be very good journalism. But right in the middle of the piece, I don't know why they decided to do it, but they plopped in an aerial photo of U.S. Sugar. An aerial photo, and just basically blamed them for the red tide. I said, "Oh my God, are we getting in trouble?" Well, the problem was, and CNN, gets a buy on this because Sugar's not stupid. They're not going to go after CNN. They would look stupid. So who do they go after? The professor on the boat who was taking the samples. And they actually wrote a rebuttal or did a rebuttal on TV down in Fort Myers, Florida. It hasn't gone national. I'd be glad to show it to you if you want to see it. But anyhow, then all of a sudden, my career came to a roaring, screeching halt. Not halt, but my administration thinks I'm a hot potato, let's put it that way. Don't get invited for anything related to red tide now down there. And I didn't do it. I did not call it on. So anyhow, that's a very interesting thing of how when the press puts something in, they better acknowledge it. And they discussed it. Anderson Cooper actually asked the reporter, "Now, does Sugar know about this, and what do they say?" And they read a rebuttal that they've had online for some time. "We didn't do it." And they've got a very valid point, by the way. So we're continuing to look for what the cause of red tide is. I think it could be rainfall. Very likely, rainfall is a very important part of it with all the nitrogen that's in our rain these days. But we also think it could be the Mississippi River. Do you remember that Mississippi River that I talked about a little bit ago? There is a theory now that there's so much nitrogen going down from the Midwest to the Gulf of Mexico, it would take like 0.01% of it to veer off to the left, get into the cycle. There are circulation patterns on the west coast of, and that could be the reason too. The third reason we give is because Sugar got mad at me, I got mad back at them. We are investigating back pumping. Sugar uses the state of Florida. Boy, do they use the state of Florida. The state of Florida, whenever the water level gets too deep on the sugar fields, they have what they call back pumping, and they do pump nutrient, laden waters off agriculture fields back into Lake Okeechobee. And we've just now, I won't give the numbers because I still want to double, triple, quadruple check these things before we go public, but that's a bunch of water. And so they're not completely off the hook. So anyhow, that's a long story.
Thanks, Bill. And we still love you in Ohio. I don't know if I told you this, but...
I might be coming back to Ohio.
I did the story on the wet culture project that you right. have with... they put it on page one, and my managing editor came to me, and I thought, okay, I'm doing a story on a guy whose theory is that we could save Lake Erie with, by restoring parts of the Great Black Swamp. For whatever reason, my publisher... told my managing editor he just absolutely loved that story.
Really?
I was really excited about it.
Yeah, I might come back.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so next up is Lynn Henning, who I introduced before, and Lynn at great expense to her and others. I mean, she's been working in the trenches, so to speak, for a long time. She's had threats made against her. She's had people, following her on lonely highways and animals stuffed in her mailbox. She's gone through the whole bit here, and but she's been fighting the good fight and can tell us about CAFO activism.
Hi, everyone. We've been in this issue for about 20 years now, and it started back in the early days where we had a CAFO in our community that had discharged to a recreational lake. And we got accused of actually turning them in when we didn't know anything about it. So I guess that kind of launched us into it. So over the years, now I work for Socially Responsible Agricultural Project. I cover the entire United States for CAFOs in every state, helping people organize and understand and where to find the information. And we train water rangers on the ground. And we're now just starting microcystis testing with test strips to start acknowledging that we're getting microcystis directly from CAFO fields. And in 2015, we did a report, and we had heard that there was only 35,000 animals in the Western Lake Erie Basin. So I want to kind of bring you in and give you like a pinpoint view of the Western Lake Erie in Michigan, just to give you an idea of what we do at the bottom. I'm not the professors and do their wonderful work at this end. I'm at the bottom, I dig in the ditches, okay. I am a farmer, and when we started the report, we found that there was 12 million livestock in the Western Lake Erie Basin. There was 146 CAFOs, 57 in Ohio, 75 in Indiana, 14 in Michigan, that produced 630 million gallons of waste. And we didn't estimate this. We went right and we got FOIAs and we did every document out of all three states. Just in my county alone, and I live at the headwaters of Lake Erie, we have 12 CAFOs within a 10-mile radius of our farm. And just our county alone had 81 violations. And what we found in that report, we also did subsidies through the Farm Bill, and just the Western Lake Erie Basin at that time had received over $16.8 million in subsidies. And then finding out that there was a total phosphorus decrease, but the DRP, which is a dissolved reactive phosphorus, was increasing. Then they did two studies. One showed that conservation tillage and no-till and field tile were increased the dissolved reactive phosphorus in the Western Lake Erie Basin. So we were paying for practices that were actually creating and increasing the phosphorus in the lake. The second study showed that 42% of the CAFOs, and these are just the 12 CAFOs in my area, had over 50 parts per million. Now in the Michigan permit, you can have up to 150 parts per million of phosphorus. But we know that the recommendations are 40 parts per million.
That's a lot.
And then they began overestimating the crops at 67%, saying they were going to get more crop yield than what they would actually get. And then they were applying beyond the permits. We see multiple applications on fields on the ground from multiple CAFOs on the same fields. So 26% of them they figured were over applying, which would equal the equivalent of 11,800 acres or 18.4 miles just from 12 CAFOs that they could take the excessive over-application and apply on that many more acres. So that was our first report, Follow the Manure, in 2015. And then we had requests to do Watershed Moment in 2017, which was the entire state of Michigan. There was 272 CAFOs. We did this in late 2016. We took the data. There's over 20.6 million animals in Michigan that produce 3.3 billion gallons of liquid animal waste. 79.5% was dairy, 2.5% was beef, 1.5% poultry, and 8% swine. The majority of the CAFO waste is not treated, and the subsidies for Michigan at that time, and please understand that this doesn't count state or local subsidies or bonds or insurance, $103.8 million. And these are practices that are contributing. And what we're seeing a lot of is you can't use liquid animal waste over field time. Over the years, the state methods have come in, and any applications over 3,000 to 4,000 gallons per acre go right to the field tile, which are like city sewage systems underneath the ground out in the country. And some are up to 3 feet deep. They may be in grids. But what it does is your macropore holes have holes and cracks, and it goes right to the tile lines and vents. So we catch them applying in rain. I want to show this as an example. This was taken on August 15th, and we trained people on the ground, and this was one of the local groups that we trained. This is over 100,000 E. coli when over 300 is full body contact for swimming. This was at the headwaters of the South Branch of the River Raisin. DEQ was called for the state of Michigan. They arrived like 6 to 8 hours later. They took samples. They did not send them in to be tested. The farmer or the CAFO operator got a letter of non-compliance. If you want them to handle it, yes. You can smell it if you want. If
it's only funny because we're in 10 of the 6 we know all the time.
We'll leave that up to you. The interesting part about this is the local group, the Environmentally Concerned Citizens in South Michigan, was one of the first groups in the country to start monitoring. They have an online database that's documented for 20 years at the headwaters of Lake Erie. There's been water studies that they've done. They're doing DNA testing. No takers. just to give you an idea, but what's interesting is we're having problems with people not being trained to come down and do the water testing for the state, where the people, the citizen scientists on the ground, have more knowledge of what's going on. So we're concerned with that because we see people go through the jobs and then we have to restart again on the facilities for their district. So what we're seeing is a lot of over-application, or they can't get there in time, or the excuses of, well, it doesn't look that bad, we're not going to take samples. I believe Tom, he came out on a tour with us one day. And we called the state because we had a discharge happening. And
oh, yeah, I remember seeing that.
They wouldn't come down, would they, Tom?
No, they didn't.
And so a lot of times we document because on the ground, because we have people getting ill in the area, we document. At that time, the local group had a registered nurse in the group that would document health effects around the community. And the other factor is you can't not only put liquid waste on tile fields, is the nutrient management plans are turning into the state where they put a spread plan in that they're going to put hay in for 3 years. They're not putting hay in, they'll put corn in, they'll put more waste out when the hay field wasn't supposed to receive any. So we're now getting the states and feds acclimated that they're not following their nutrient management plans. And then the other factor is they have multiple names. I have a facility in Iowa that has 73 businesses registered at one address. Okay, so we have 73 facilities under one name at one address. And what we're finding is they're getting federal subsidies for all these different names, because they're registered as LLCs somewhere else. So there's a lot of kind of a web to this, where there's branches of things that are happening. On the ground, we're seeing tremendous over-application. We're seeing what we're trying to do is coordinate with scientists when they have the algae blooms in Lake Erie, that from April to November, we're watching the land applications, and when they seem to spike is when they're heavily field playing after hay harvest or wheat harvest on cracked ground where it's dry, and then we're seeing algae blooms within a certain time after that, when the extreme applications in the area are happening. So we'll be putting in recommendations when the new permit comes out in Michigan. This is happening all over the country. We're training people on the ground on documents.
Sure.
And do test strip testing to indicate for further testing. So, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. And one thing I know we've heard at this conference about lives being upended with the Flint water crisis and how they've learned, you know, they have to drink bottled water every day, things that a lot of us don't have to do. One thing that always struck me, and I know this is small potatoes to Lynn now for some of the things that they've gone through, but almost any time she leaves her house, she calls the sheriff's department because the neighbors who don't like her are prone to, you know, or we're prone to call and make up things or follow, track, or harass her. And the day I was, she mentioned I was out there, I know that was one of the things. And I've heard that from some other activists too, that they often feel better if they call the sheriff's department just to let them know they're going to be on public roads in their own areas. So that's
yes, we actually give license plate number and what vehicles will be out, and if we're out doing training, how many people will be training with us, and kind of what our location will be. So, and we've had many tours where we've had people come from other countries to give them tours on the ground of what CAFOs are, because they're trying to come in Europe and all over. So we have people that come here just specifically for that.
Yeah, and I was there for one of those visits with some people from Germany, I remember. So why don't you go next, John, bringing up the rear here, and John's going to give us more of a broader perspective across the across America here.
Absolutely. Tom, thanks. Again, my name is John Rumpler. I'm Senior Attorney and Clean Water Program Director with Environment America. For those of you who don't know us, we're a national organization, a federation of state-based groups in 29 states across the country with a million supporters and activists and other folks following our work. And as Clean Water Program Director, we've been deeply concerned about the problem of safe drinking water from threats from toxic algae as well as lead. And it's ironic that I was invited to come here all the way to Flint not to talk about our Get the Lead Out campaign, but to talk about toxic algae. But I guess bottom line is, whatever the threat is, we believe that all Americans deserve safe drinking water. So I want to thank, you know, the indispensable work of the scientists on my left and the activists on the ground, Lynn, and the work that she's doing. Let me try to sort of tie things together a little bit from a broader perspective. I guess the first thing I want to say is just this problem of these toxic algal outbreaks is really affecting people all across the country. We've heard about Lake Erie here, and we've heard as far away as Lake Balaton. But let me tell you that in Salem, Oregon this summer, they had to shut off the water, and the state of Oregon ordered up to 100 water utilities to test for toxic algae because of water contamination there. In Florida, we heard a little bit about the red tide, but similarly, the other guacamole-like algae that's getting to the Atlantic side, right around the time that there was tremendous coverage of the red tide, 15 people were sent to the hospital near St. Lucie River with algae-like symptoms. So this toxic algae is a huge, huge problem. There are many, many sources of nutrient pollution, as Robert was indicating. There are no factory farms near where I live in Boston. And yet, I remember walking along the Charles River just a few weeks ago, and as I'm seeing sailboats, and I'm seeing people walking by, and I'm seeing all this beautiful scenery along this river that's made a lot of progress, I also see this big sign that says, warning, cyanobacteria. Runoff pollution of various kinds is also a big source of the problem. But for today, I just want to focus on the pollution from corporate agribusiness as a major, major source of the toxic algal outbreaks that we're seeing. And let me pause for just a second, because word choice is so important in journalism. I worry that we talk about blooms and we talk about nutrients. Nutrients sound good, they make things grow. Blooms sound good, like beautiful flowers. But actually, we sort of think that these toxic algae episodes are more like a disease. So we should call them algae outbreaks rather than algal blooms. And we are trying to do that. And just an observation on the wordsmithing.
NOAA in its weekly HAP bulletins calls it scum, which is great, because the scientists themselves have adopted the word scum.
I'll take scum as a friendly amendment. Talking to the sources of corporate agribusiness, we did an analysis in 2016, and I should say I don't have any slides, but if you go to the Hoova app, under the comments section for this panel, I put up two links to really important resources. First of all, Tony Bartolome from the Post and Courier did an amazing map of algal outbreaks across the country. So there's a link to that there if you go to the app. And secondly, to the report that we did in 2016 called Corporate Agribusiness in America's Waterways. We basically analyzed that in addition to the factory farms that Lynn was talking about, these concentrated animal operations and the massive manure that they generate, that there are two other pathways of pollution making its way to our waterways to cause these algal outbreaks and other problems. The second pathway is the crops, right? All of the grain that needs to be grown to feed these animals and the required nutrient inputs to grow that corn and soybean and so forth, that's a huge source of runoff pollution as well. And thirdly, perhaps smaller by volume, but important for several policy reasons, are the slaughterhouses and the processing plants of these massive meat companies. So we looked, and one of the things that's fascinating is that although it's hard to show exactly how much pollution is running off of the cropland from all of those tiles that Lynn was talking about, these major meat companies are required to report to state agencies under their NPDES permits, under the Clean Water Act, as well as to the toxic release inventory, to show, at least for toxins, how much they're discharging to waterways. And by the way, nitrates are included under TRI. So what we did is we looked at five major meat companies, Tyson, Purdue, Cargill, why am I forgetting the other two? But Smithfield, thank you, and JBS, which is the second largest or maybe largest protein producer in the world. I think that's what they say on their website. And we looked at their operations in the United States. And what we found, let me summarize the numbers for Tyson. We weren't able to analyze the runoff from the fields. But just by calculating the numbers of hogs and cows and chickens that go through Tyson's supply chain, we calculated that Tyson's pollution footprint, the amount of manure that they generate, is 55 million tons for the years that we looked at. 55 million tons of animal waste generated through their supply chain. How much of that makes it into our waterways? Let's ask Tyson. I don't know. But they should be able to tell us and be held accountable for it. And then we looked at the TRI numbers for the direct discharges from their slaughterhouses and their processing plants. And for the TRI years of 2010 to 2014, the self-reported numbers to TRI from Tyson showed 104 million pounds of nitrates and other toxins from their discharge plants. And that's an important part of the pollution program profile, and it's one that can be more easily regulated through NPDES permits under the Clean Water Act. So that gives us an idea of the scope of the problem, or at least the sources of this pollution. Let me talk about some strategies and solutions of what we need to do to get our hands around it. Two basic things we need to do. Number one, absolutely, we need to restore and protect wetlands, as Bill was saying before. Bill was talking about the importance of wetlands. Let me put this in a policy context. I think yesterday during the lunch panel, it was mentioned the Clean Water Rule, otherwise known as the Waters of the United States. Environment America worked with many other allies for more than a dozen years to win that Clean Water Rule, which in addition to restoring protections for streams around the country, restored protections of the Federal Clean Water Act to millions of acres of wetlands across the country. I agree with Bill that we need to do more than just protect the ones we have now. We need to restore more of them, but we certainly can't lose any more. And the Clean Water Rule is a critical tool, and right now it's being fought in the courts, fought by the current administration. I can tell you more about that if we have time, but protecting wetlands is a critical part of what we need to do. But the second part of what we need to do really goes to what Lynn was saying, which is we need to stop this pollution at its source. We need to reform the way we grow our food in this country. It simply makes no sense to grow our food in ways that poison our water. And we know that the solutions are out there. Whether we're talking about buffer strips, whether we're talking about cover crops, whether we're talking about plant-based alternatives to meat, Even Tyson, as bad as their pollution footprint was that we calculated, is now starting to invest in plant-based alternatives. So that's a good move. We need to see the industry do that more and much faster because time is running out with these toxic algal outbreaks. The last thing that I just want to do, given that I am senior attorney, is I want to just highlight for you a new litigation strategy that we are rolling out that I'll dubiously call Slaughterhouse 5. Yeah, might as well just roll that in. I was indicating to you before that these processing plants, although they're not the largest source of nitrogen and phosphorus, they are directly regulated under NPDES permits of the Clean Water Act. And so we have started to look at these discharges and see where they're in violation of their Clean Water Act limits. And we found in Florida that Pilgrim's Pride had a plant in Live Oaks that was dumping a huge amount of pollution into the Suwannee River, thousands of times that we found them exceeding their Clean Water Act permits. And together with our litigation team at the National Environmental Law Center, we took them to court. 6 months later, we had a settlement for $1.43 million with Pilgrim's Pride, one of the largest chicken producers in the world. And not only did they agree to reduce their pollution through pollution control at the plant, they agreed that more than $1 million of that settlement would go to a fund being administered by Stetson University in Florida to assist farmers in switching to more sustainable practices to reduce water pollution into the Suwannee River watershed. Mm. So it's an interesting strategy to try to get a hold of the agribusiness problem from this slaughterhouse processing angle, and we're looking forward to doing more of the same. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, John. And as he said during his presentation, another reason to download the WHOVA app here for the conference, if you had it, there's some more information that you can find there. Also, I know a lot of you in this room know this: the primary algal toxin here in western Lake Erie and some other parts of the world, Microcystis, is it usually attacks the liver. It can can cause a whole host of problems there, being a liver toxin, a neurotoxin. But there's also some research going on. There's a new documentary out that Harrison Ford narrates on the science going into the possibility of connections to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's disease, and also Alzheimer's in other parts of the world. And it's a very, very fascinating look. There were 75 people who died in Brazil of this, but they were back in 1995, but they were pretty much sitting ducks. They were in a kidney dialysis center, and they were basically given poison water when the treatment system there broke down that was poisoned by this toxin. Most of the time when you hear about algae, well, you don't hear about the good algae because there are hundreds of good types of algae that support the food chain, but the HABs, harmful algal blooms, i.e. blue-green algae, blue-green, and cyanobacteria, those are the ones you have to look for. So let's go to Q&A. We got about 15 minutes or so. We'll entertain some questions there. Go ahead. Please identify yourself and the usual protocol, SEJ members and working journalists first.
Hi, my name is Jason Mark. I'm the editor of Sierra Magazine. Lynn, I've got a follow-up question for you. I thought I heard you say, when you were talking about practices that are contributing to phosphorus, I thought I heard you say that low-till and no-till is also a contributing factor. Is that what you said?
Yes, that was a study done by Dr. Baker, and I'll send that to Tom so he'll have that study. But they had specifically said in that study that it's an unintended consequence due to the conservation practices, and no-till was listed. Yeah. And what it does is it concentrates the phosphorus in the top layers of the soil, so it's more soluble.
So then how do you manage, or what's the best thing about, because obviously we do want soil conservation practices, that we're not stripping away topsoil, we're conserving topsoil, so how do you manage the competing interest of soil conservation with then, of course, not having this awful runoff? I mean, there seems to be a tension there between a couple public goods.
That's the thing, is they have they're studying this stuff right now, and you have so many different tillage practices that they haven't recommended a new best management practice, but there's a lot of minimum till, there's a lot of the mulch till. There's all different practices right now. But this study came out, and it was interesting because they specifically named that those practices, along with the fact that they were paying money for erosion, to control erosion rather than the dissolved reactive phosphorus. That was also brought up at the Michigan Department of Ag Commission, too.
And Lynn's right, because when I came here in 1993, everyone was preaching no-till, and in recent years, I don't know if there's a rock-solid consensus on it, but there's certainly many more people looking at, is it possible that, you know, through many years of no-till, that the soil's being compacted and there's, you know, more rapid runoff that way, and so it's... I think there's a lot more research going into it, but there's questions being raised about, you know, some of the better farming practices that even were promoted, 20 years ago. So,
I was just going to comment that I'm very familiar with that study. Dave's a good scientist, but there are studies that say the opposite as well. There are a lot of studies that say the opposite as well. That one got a lot of press because of what it said. But there are a large number of soil scientists who study till versus no-till, and they do not agree with that conclusion.
I thought I would chime in here to just say, not that I am in a position to resolve the debate between the scientists, but to perhaps suggest that we can't rely on low-till or no-till alone to solve this nutrient problem, mm-hmm. That really the key is to reduce the fertilizer and manure inputs onto the land, and we're never going to solve this problem if we don't do that.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Thanks for this great presentation. Rich Blousing, freelance journalist. I have a question for William Mitch.
Mm-hmm.
Rich Blousing, freelance journalist. So in 2011, we had the RSCJ conference in Miami. We went to Sugar Country, we went to Loco Pitobi, and we also stormwater treatment area.
Yeah.
So let me just ask, I gather when you talk about restored wetlands, you talk about the STAs, the stormwater treatment areas?
Yes, even though their lawyers don't allow them to use the word wetlands, they are wetlands, I can assure you.
So what you have, and I'll be really quick here, you have a big agriculture north of Lake Okeechobee, which is highly responsible for the eutrophication. Then south is Sugar, and that's where you have contested land for more restored wetlands.
I'll just explain what needs to happen in a very simple answer to that. You're right. We all want the water to flow north-south, like the Everglades was at one time. But in order for it to flow north-south, it has to go through, not around, through, even if it's in pipes, Sugar. Sugar is basically south of Lake Okeechobee. That's how they got off the hook, by the way, when in their analysis of whether they're contributing to red tide, they are adamant. We didn't do it. We're south of Lake Okeechobee. So there's a very it's a tough call as to how you would get 100,000 acres from them, given that they had already contributed some lands for those SDAs, also known as treatment wetlands. I call them wetlands, and they are. So the first point is they've built 57,000 acres of these wetlands, 57,000 acres. That's the largest assemblage of wetlands anywhere in the world built to clean up water. And they work. They go down to the 15 to 17 part per billion range, not part per million. We use part per billion in Florida. And so they're working very well. So we just say we need more. If you're going to send the whole kit and caboodle south instead of sending it and destroying the estuaries, which we need to do, in other words, it has to go south, we're going to need a lot more wetlands. And Sugar is the only parcel of land left where we can do that. I'm sorry, Sugar, we have to borrow 100,000 more acres from you, but you have 600,000 more, and you can keep farming on that. There's no other place to put these wetlands. There's no other way to solve the phosphorus problem going false, and we might as well solve the nitrogen problem too, because all this water that goes south eventually ends up in Florida Bay, and that's a marine system.
But you also have to better regulate the farmers north.
Well, of course. Now, Lake Okeechobee is so eutrophic. It's beyond being saved, in my view. And then they say, well, can we dredge it? Well, yeah, you could dredge Lake Michigan, too, while you're at it. It's just so humongous in size. They're never going to be able to dredge it and clean it up. That's a typical thing that would happen for a smaller lake. So Lake Okeechobee, we just now have to consider it. It is a source of pollution, just like agriculture. It's emitting. In fact, there were pictures. I don't know if any of you saw them on the base social media. It showed green water, pure green water, coming out of Lake Okeechobee and going into the rivers that were going to pollute the Atlantic Ocean and estuaries and the Gulf of Mexico estuaries. It's green already. We're pumping the algae plus the nutrients down to our coastlines right now.
Chris, I think you're next. Yeah.
I'm Chris Kick. I'm with Farm and Dairy newspaper. We're an agriculture paper in Ohio, Pennsylvania. And I really appreciate, the idea of expanding the wetlands and the value of those. And I think I've seen a couple of the studies that have shown, just what a filtering benefit, even a minimal amount of wetlands. But to get to the 100,000, and I think maybe it could take that much, how would you suggest compensating the private landowners, or what do we do about the fact that for many of them it is their livelihood?
Right. No, the question was, how do we compensate agriculture and farmers, especially if we are coming in and I guess basically taking the land? We're working on a business model, by the way, for our wetland culture, and this would apply as well. There are all sorts of government programs that pay you for doing good things. And cleaning up water is one. Sequestering carbon is another. Third is developing ecological habitats. So if you create a wetland, you get all three of those benefits. Now, here's the problem, and it's not our problem. The problem is the federal government doesn't think that way. So we have a term for it now. We call it stacking benefits. For example, if you get a benefit for carbon, there's a carbon economy emerging of wetlands sequestering carbon. And by the way, if you want to sequester carbon, build a wetlands. Best approach known to mankind. So carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus, wetlands can take care of. So you got a lot of issues with the way the government does their calculations. It's not an ecological issue. A wetland can do more than one thing. So we're looking for maybe if we start agreeing that wetlands can do more than one thing. They can take nutrients out, they can sequester carbon, and they can produce a very nice, viable habitat. It could be that it could be a business. You could make money.
Right. I mean, it could be timber.
Yeah, and hunting and fishing rights and so on. So it's not out of the question that you could have a landscape, and this is what we envision with our wetland culture idea. You could have a landscape of wetlands and agriculture looking like a checkerboard kind of approach. If you looked in the air, you see a wetland and you see agriculture, and they'd be flipping all the time. Now, what I mean by flipping, I don't like the idea of rotating. That sounds so pedestrian, but the young people now like to flip houses, so I thought, well, we'll do flipping of landscapes. So here's basically the landscape we need of the future. You have intermixing wetlands and intermixing agriculture. When you want to take the nutrients out of the water, that's a wetland. And it does a great job, especially phosphorus. That phosphorus stays in the soil. It doesn't go in the atmosphere like some. So the phosphorus will stay in the soil. It will be a wetland for X number of years. And then you flip it to agriculture and pull the plug and put your corn seeds in there, and you don't have to fertilize. That's the whole idea. So we'd have a landscape, and it might be a wetland for 3 years and a agriculture for two. Those are the numbers we're trying to get from our experiments.
Yeah. I immediately think of CRP, which is the Conservation Reserve Program.
Right, right.
That pays farmers to leave ground, fallow for certain years.
Yes.
If it gets criticism,
anyhow, if I were a farmer, and somebody said you can be out there flipping wetlands and agriculture, I thought that'd be a ball. That would be, so that's our idea. of not only compensating, but actually making it a sort of a wetland culture industry.
We have time for a couple more quick ones. Anybody else has any other questions? Anybody? Going?
I was just going to follow up on Chris's question. Just, it's a shame that the Farm Bill has not been reauthorized, that it's been hung up in Congress, because, of course, the CREP program and many other programs and reforming of the EQIP program to ensure that more of that money is going into practices that truly reduce pollution could be a way to both protect water and a win for farmers as well.
I agree. Okay, we got a taker. Well, why don't you ask yours first, because he's got a follow-up, and you can ask yours first.
I was going to ask, you mentioned 5 million acres as sort of a big number for the U.S.
Could you identify yourself, too?
Oh, sorry. Or Rowan Morgarity. I'm a freelancer. I live in New York. When you look around the world, are there any examples of a sort of government-led or, you know, other sort of audacious initiatives on an analogous scale? I mean,
not 5 million, but again, federal government asked us what it would take to clean up hypoxia. It is a massive job. That, by the way, is only a couple percent of the Mob River Basin. And if we're smart, we'd be strategic and be with the that's a nitrogen issue, we think. So we'd create these wetlands where nitrogen's high. And that's the Midwest United States. That's where it is. So, yeah, 5 million is a reach. We knew that when we proposed it. And I didn't think it would take 20 years for them to mull it over and still, oh, well, Bill, we got to do some other calculation. You know, they've been mulling it over long enough. Now, maybe they just, Louisiana's learned to live with hypoxia. That's probably what's going on right now.
But I meant like in China or other, you know, there are other countries around the world that have sort of more unified policy-making apparatus.
Well, Tai Hu, which you heard a lot of about. I've been there many times. I've been there almost those 40 years you talked about. Tai Hu, now, admittedly, we were a wetland conference, but it was 2016 I was there, and I said, what's going on? It's not green. So they have, because of the type of government that China has, if they identify a problem, and I think they've all identified it as a problem, and they find the source, they can shut them down overnight. And that's what goes on in China that doesn't go on in the rest of the world. So the sources have been cut down. One of the most popular things now in China, unbelievable popularity. Every city you go to, they are building wetland parks. Mm-hmm. And they deliberately call them parks. They're building wetland parks, and they don't even tell people that it's cleaning water. They always build a museum, a wetland museum when they build one of these parks. And, yeah, they tell them all about the values, but when the people are walking around there, they really don't register that, wait, this is a beautiful wetland, and they don't register that maybe it's cleaning up the water, which it usually is. So I know upstream of Tai Hu, they built like a half a dozen wetland parks. Beautiful, 100 acres, more than that, wetland parks. They're the rage in China right now because you got to remember, Asian cultures grew up with water on their landscape. They had fish ponds and they had rice. So to them, it's a nostalgia kind of thing. We drained everything in sight in the USA. We drained it, and we have no sense of that water on the landscape is a good thing. So I think that's why the Chinese not only picked up the idea of wetlands. I was blamed for building the wetland at Ohio State University. That's where they're copying. I don't know if that's true, but I'll take the credit. But no, there is a lot of interest in the world in creating wetlands, and it's for all sorts of reasons. And I guess that's my final comment: is wetlands do more than one thing.
Do you still have a follow up?
A different subject, different science. Dr. McKinney, Dr. Wilhelm, so you showed us blooms that flip back. What's the fundamental science for the flip back? Is that because there needs to be a steady stream of nitrogen, potassium, or is there just something cyclic in the blooms?
What do you mean flip back?
They last only 9 months.
Oh, okay. I mean, in part, that's it's multiple factors. We often see Temperature being an important factor there. So the seasonality we have in north temperate environments is key to the longevity of the bloom. But then if you measure nutrient profiles in those locations, you'll see a depletion of nitrogen and phosphorus. Sandusky Bay, for example, we have we'll have pulses of nutrients coming in the spring, consistent with you know, snow melt and higher rain. Pulse of nutrients coming in, and then they start to stimulate the growth of these algae. The algae then start depleting the nutrients, and they actually do it very quickly, and they store them. They sort of the rainy day approach. They actually have storage bodies inside the cells that they can store nitrogen, for example, and then draw from it later in the season when there's not so much nitrogen coming in from the streams or rivers.
Okay, I'm told we're done. Appreciate everyone coming. Hope you got something out of it, and feel free to follow up. We're now heading down for lunch.
You're right.
We'll be here. This doesn't matter.